Namaste, welcome back to English History Fact and Fiction, episode the 213th. Mary gets stitched up. Oh dear. My name's Sick Newman. Let's circle back. See, even your podcaster can do mass so long as it was Johann Sebastian Bach who wrote the thing. Last time was about getting everyone to 1581, with lots of it being about George Talbot and Bess of Hardwick with their guest, Mary Queen of Scots. That's enough to put anyone's marriage on the rocks. Sir Francis Drake went all rock star on us, and we finished up with a further squeeze at weirdo Dr. John Dee. Betty has issued a proclamation, which is more of the police state variety. English who have children, wards or kinsmen anywhere overseas needs to give in their names and have them back in England within 4 months. This is to stem the tide of the incoming English priests. Looks harsh, does it not? The problem isn't so much with the priests coming in to do the Latin magic show, it's that the Pope has given them instructions to also disrupt the government, and that's what's at the heart of the problem. The church wants to interfere with the state in a negative manner. Still, if you're totally fair-income Protestant who just wants a bit of an overseas education, then you can apply to go. Still, it's travel restrictions, and who likes that? Cecil will be one of those who assesses requests to travel. He'll examine the applicant's knowledge of England, and if he isn't satisfied, then that person will be told to stay home and find out what his own country is about first, before going overseas. Good for domestic tourism, then. Parliament will seek harsher penalties for Catholics, and Betty can only say yes to satisfy the Protestants. Enough business. Betty wants entertainment, so I thought this might be a nice one for her. We have four knights who will challenge a castle named the Castle of Perfect Beauty. A page boy will demand the castle surrender and get an O. He can then make a flowery speech and the besieging will get underway. Two cannon go off, but one has perfumed powder, with the other one having perfumed water. Having fired our cannon, the hard men will assault the castle with flowers. Out come the defenders in all sorts of get-ups. We even get Adam and Eve, with Eve being played by Sir Anthony Cook. Yeah, women can't act. It goes on, but that's enough entertainment for me. It's a metaphor and stuff that I don't really like. Yeah, metaphors don't do it for me. But it's not all hooting and giggling for Betty. She had partied hard when Alencon was in England, but now we'll go back to working for England. Betty's been doing this job for 24 years, with daily flattery, or perhaps constant flattery. This may have led to a bit of vanity and an exaggerated idea on her own wisdom and power. That's seen her becoming a bit more stern and maybe a bit more like a despot. Still, none of us can avoid time, and Betty is liking the mirror less and less. That in turn is leading her to be not so nice to young people, particularly good-looking young people, particularly good-looking young girly people. She likes to ask her ladies if they think much about marriage. Smart ones have learned to say, no way. Serving you, O Gloriana, is the best thing in the world. Who wants a yucky man? One who was not so smart said, oh yes, I think about marriage all the time. Betty will say, oh fine, kiddo, let me help you out. Betty will bring in the dad and say, your daughter wants to marry. He'll say, I had no idea, but of course, your most gorgeous majesty, I give my right to approve her marriage to your overabundant wisdom. In comes the lady, and Betty will give her the good news. Your dad said that I could choose the man for you. Great, says our lady, then I shall do whatever to please your grace. Good, says Betty, seeing as I now have the power of consent, you shall be marrying nobody. Now get back to work. Betty's also getting more than a bit cranky with the Catholics. It's all the frequent reports of plots and assassination attempts. The council will detail one about the guy they had nabbed, showing Betty the intended murder weapon, and said perhaps she should stay home more. Betty will say she'd rather be dead than in custody. She's also cranky with Ireland, that place of never-ending rebellion, and it doesn't matter if she sends that smart operator Sydney or dickhead Devereux, there's no end to the troubles. Her policies towards Ireland will harden. It's to be severity, not indulgence, in dealing with Ireland. Her top guys will also cop it. Cecil will frequently find harsh words from his queen, and he'll even complain, saying, "Hey, I copped a hard time over a good job well done." George Talbot, of course, will be another to complain that he gets frequent grief from Betty. Walsingham will console Henry Sidney after he copped a spray, saying, "Hey, mate, don't take her to heart. She's prone to this, but you can expect an apology or a nice present when she's thought it through." It's, of course, not only the Catholics giving a hard time on religion. Let's not forget those Puritans who are reminding her of the prophets of the old Book of Magic getting stuck into rulers who they saw as not religious enough. Robert Brown will complete his studies in divinity at Cambridge and be straight off to Norwich to preach against Betty's Protestant church. It's way too Catholic for Robert. He thinks that each and every church should be allowed to do its own thing. It'll be off to the summer for Robert. Guilty of contumacy, our word for the day, meaning to resist the authorities. Good news for Robert Brown. Cecil, his relative, will get him out and suggest perhaps a different country. Off he goes to Lowlands to do his thing and publish a book on his way of the magic stuff. Two English guys will be hanged for distributing his book in England. Betty is starting to persecute the Protestants, or, well, really, the Puritans. They're Protestants too. The hanging, by the way, was for failing to acknowledge Betty's supremacy of the church in England. Back comes Robert from the Lowlands to be in and out of the slammer. 32 times. Eventually, they will threaten him with excommunication, so he'll say, "Oh, okay, I'll surrender and be a good Anglican," and he will be. He won't be a good citizen, though, and will die in the slammer for belting a policeman. It was thought he might have been insane, but even though he's given away his Puritan ideas, those ideas, though, will live on with the separatist church, which still operates today. Main difference between Puritans and separatists is that Puritans wanted to change the Anglican church entirely, make it all Puritan, while separatists wanted to do the Puritan thing away from the Anglican church. Robert Brown will be known as the father of those pilgrims that will soon be leaving England to go and get the USA started. Archie Grindle can complete his final times crossword puzzle and die. Now, he's got a couple of years left in him, but he's a lame duck who is not well. He's trying to complete his letter of resignation, but Betty will just appoint a new Archie in Canterbury. She can't wait for him to write that letter. Betty will choose Whitgift, Bishop of Worcester, who got a mention for his blue against the Puritan Cartwright. He's single, and Betty likes her churchy types unmarried. He's good at business, whether secular or ecclesiastical, puts on a good dinner, and has lots of servants to give him a nice bit of pomp. And he's rather hard on those servants. They have to all constantly kneel for him. He's a smart cookie, having taught guys like Francis Bacon, and seeing the lad was rather smart, bought him books on Plato and Cicero. What Betty really likes about this lad, though, is that he is definitely anti-Puritan. He's just the right sort of a guy to stitch up Robert Brown and his separatists. We've seen the re-establishment of the underground church. It was a thing that kicked off in London for Protestants under Bloody Mary. In came Betty and, hey, no need for it. But then we had that controversy over whether the magician should wear a little black cocktail frock or the full fuchsia ball gown with diamante tiara, and the underground church was back in business. It's big, it's organised, and it really liked the Robert Brown stuff, so our man Whitgift will be busy infiltrating it and busting up magic shows, tossing guys in the slammer, that sort of stuff. Won't really work, though, because you cannot kill an idea. Whitgift is a nasty piece of work and great for what Betty wants. He will ask for more power and more power, and Betty's persecution of certain Protestants has begun. Betty had asked Grindle to check in on non-conformity amongst the magicians, and he'd said no. Whitgift will be suspending magicians all over the place for being too Calvinistic or not doing the Book of Common Prayer Magic Show the right way. Council will call him in for a please explain. There's too many guys getting the boot. Griff will just reply, none of your fucking business, my lads. I'm on a mission from God, and the only person I report to is Betty. After a year or so of tying up the frontline magic guys, Whitgift will ask if he can establish a second High Commission court. The original one, you might recall, really doesn't do anything. Whitgift is thinking that the new one may work along the lines of, say, the sweet, dear, kind, loving and gentle brothers of St. Dominic. He wants the keys to the torture chamber. It's not just torture. Whitgift will get the power to license printers and will get legislation to limit the number of printing presses, and he can also be the censorship office. Whitgift is also railing against the Puritans, and we should remember that Dudley and Cecil are a bit Puritan themselves. If you're being looked at by Whitgift then, you need a powerful protector, because Whitgift's too smart to upset guys like Dudley and Cecil. Still, Cecil will be upset by seeing harsher treatment going to magicians, some of whom are really pious guys. They're just not following orders to the letter. He'll also get hold of Whitgift's list of questions that he puts to people. Cecil will write, hey, look, this could have been written by the Spanish Inquisition. It's just designed to entrap people. Whitgift will say, oh, hey, mate, have you ever been to a fair trial, in air quotes, in the Star Chamber, or anywhere in England for that matter? I'm just doing what every other court in England does. But Cecil, helped by Walsingham, will get that stuff toned down. One of the very few backdowns for Whitgift. But he will now start saying Puritans are a greater threat to state security than Catholics. Executions will ramp up. Sir Francis Knollys will say, hey, Biddy, this Whitgift dude is usurping your position as head of the church. Too late, Sir Francis. Whitgift has got to Betty. He'll be with Betty until her dying day. Betty has swiped left on Alencon, so we better see how it's going in France. Earthquake in Calais, torrential rain and flooding in Paris. Not one, not two, but three hits of the epidemic in a year. The second one seems to have been cholera, with Catherine, King Henri and the Duke of Guise all getting a dose. The cholera will disappear just as the plague hits. Nobles will flood out of Paris with their houses left as easy pickings for the poor. That's nice. Even the Louvre will cop it. Around 140,000 less Frenchies to feed after all that stuff. Does God hate France? That King of Portugal gig will come up and Catherine will immediately say she should be Queen of Portugal. Her credentials are pretty crap, so all she's done is annoy Spanish Phil. Again. Alessandro Farnese, Duke of Parma, will lead Spanish troops to besiege Cambria in the lowlands. Alencon wants to go again and defend the Protestants. Catherine will say no again. Alencon will go again. Betty will write to King Henri saying we should team up to belt up Spanish Phil, but he's on to Betty. It would be that France starts the war with Betty saying, oh, yeah, we'll be right behind you. Yeah, we're coming soon. Yeah, no, you keep going. We'll be there. Alencon will go to Antwerp with William of Orange and be made Duke of Brabant, which scores him the Palace of Saint Michel. He's now a big swinging dick in his own right. Spanish Phil will attack Portugal to press his claim. Catherine will send Frenchies to fight Phil. Big disaster. And the prisoners of war will just be butchered. Even King Henri, who had said, leave me out of this, I don't want war with Phil, will be outraged. Catherine will send a second force on ships supplied by Betty. Another total defeat, but at least these guys will be allowed to go home. On leaky ships, with no supplies, so lots will die. Thus endeth another stupid foreign war. Now Margot, her daughter, Margot of Nevers, will return to court. She was bored with no current lover, but Henri of Nevers was still obsessed with his mistress. She'll be a total supporter of Alencon, just to piss King Henri off. She will snub Henri's two favourites, then start an affair with Alencon's favourite. King Henri will read a gossip magazine that Margot's had a kitty. He'll order her back to Navarre. Off she goes to be stopped by the king's hard men who will search for the non-existent baby. Margot will then be arrested and taken to Henri for questioning. Margo will be furious and bang on about it was Henri himself who took her virginity. Yeah, that's not a good look. Henri of Navarre will hear about this fuss and say, he can't take Margo back unless Henri clears her name. Oh, fuck, says Henri. How do I get out of this mess? Mum will get him out of the mess. Alan Conn will get the shits in the lowlands. Not enough cash. His guys are going hungry and are deserting. Alan Conn will get into Antwerp for another massacre, and this time the nobles aren't spared. Oh, no. That makes it a horror show for our Europeans, and Alan Conn will be branded a criminal. He'll return to France, and he's not in good shape. Catherine will invite him to a meeting of big dicks, but he won't be going. Too many people hate him. Alan Conn is coughing up blood. That's not a good sign. Catherine's trying to sort out the mess he's left in the lowlands, and she'll also get ill. Alan Conn will turn up, and despite Catherine being bedridden, he will convince her to take him to see King Henri to patch up things once more. Catherine, of course, will be up to do this. The lads will have a big party with plenty of banging, then Alan Conn is off, being very unwell. Catherine will go to see him, but before she could get there, tuberculosis will do its job and Alan Conn is dead. I am so wretched to live long enough to see so many people die before me, although I realise God's will must be obeyed, that he owns everything, and that he lends us, only for as long as he likes, the children whom he gives us. Catherine knows it's worse. Unless girly King Henri can knock out an heir, and that doesn't look too promising, then the next king of France will be the heretic, Henri of Navarre.
Force of nature, don't you know I'm aware of it? But I'm so very sick of feeling so very sick. I'm tortured by the gods, I guess that I'm a heretic. Life keeps on stalking me, I wish that life was celibate.
Yeah, just a little bit of Ren there with the song Heretic. Mary Queen of Scots and another escape attempt. Duke of Guise has a cunning plan. His go-between will be Sir Francis Throckmorton, brother of our Scotty ambassador, Sir Nicholas Throckmorton. Walsingham's double agent Charles Paget will give us the information, and Sir Francis can go to visit our friendly torture chamber, where your innermost secrets will be revealed. Good stuff for Walsingham. Sir Francis will implicate the Duke of Guise, Spanish film, and the Spanish ambassador. We can break off diplomatic relations with Spain and give the ambassador the boot. Marvellous. He can no longer whinge about Francis Drake. That, though, will lead us back to Bess of Hardwick. 1582 got off to a terrible start. Bess's daughter Elizabeth, who we may call the Countess of Lennox if we want to, at 26 was dead. Her dying wish was that Betty would look after a dear little girl, Arbella. Bess, though, is devastated and won't want Arbella going anywhere. She'll write to Betty saying, if you can just keep up that payment of £400 a year that went to Elizabeth and the £200 a year for Arbella, then I can certainly care for the dear little girl. Finally, though, George will get his date to visit Betty, only to see it cancelled. He'll ask permission to take Mary, Queen of Scots, to Chatsworth because his daughter's about to have a baby. That'll be a no. Daughter will have to come to Sheffield and Bess will come too. Before you know it, Bess and George are at it, and Bess is ordered back to Chatsworth. On top of everything else, George has worked out that Walsingham's got spies in his house. Fair enough. Walsingham will find out that George's secretary had been turned into a Mary Queen of Scots spy. George will have to stop work on his new palace at Worksop. He's out of cash, so not very discreet for Bess to embark on further work at Chatsworth about the same time. Just a small job, she reckons. The lookout tower. That's what it is. It's still there, if you want to go and see it. Good news, bad news. Bess's third son, Charles Cavendish, will be knighted, but his bride of less than a year will die. George Talbot kept Cecil informed of all these things, but his letters are hardly sympathetic, complaining that Bess is constantly doing the boo-hoo-hoo stuff. Mind you, he'll be silent on the subject of Bess when his own heir, Lord Francis, dies from plague. Big blow for George. Spare heir Gilbert was a disappointment to him because Gilbert always seemed to be on Team Bess in the domestic disharmony. Worse, Gilbert's missus, Mary, is daughter of Bess, and she's always on Team Bess, and she will now get the Countess gig. 10 years of making a request to see Betty. 10 years of making requests will finally pay off. That's what I'm trying to say. With a temporary guardian for Mary appointed. George now will have to delay for a bit because of the funeral of his son, and permission to go to see Betty will be withdrawn. George had allowed a Frenchy diplomat to see Mary. Yeah, he's a bad boy. Walsingham, of course, is able to intercept letters from Mary carried out by that diplomat. Letters to Spanish Phil, Duke de Guise, and sundry Mary supporters. Plus, George had taken Mary to Magical Waters, Buxton, twice when he only had permission to go once. Is George a traitor, we all want to know? No, we all conclude. Not his nature. He's just too kind for his own good, and Mary's famous charm is working on him. Worse, his lad Francis had left a widow, Earl of Pembroke's family, and she wants a jointure, which George can't afford. Well, of course he can afford it, he just doesn't actually have the cash. Bess will now be whinging to her friends that George isn't giving her enough cash. It's all the fault of Mary Queen of Scots who has caused their marriage to break down, according to Bess. George will write a sharp letter about Bess and send it to Betty via Sir Christopher Hatton. He'll just return it, saying, oh, geez, it's a bit too harsh to give to Betty, mate. Worse, you know it is. Rumours now that Mary has had a kiddie and George is the dad. Mary will hear of it, get George in, and convince him that it was Bess and her two sons that started the rumour. Bess will be off to Sheffield because Gilbert and Mary will have another kiddie. The family will part amicably, with George saying he'd send for Bess in a few days' time. The baby died, and George did not send for Bess. Instead, he banned her from visiting any of his houses. He cancelled her pocket money. Bess will write to George, and I am obliged by law to give you a good boo-hoo-hoo warning. The innocence of my own heart is such, and my desire so infinite to procure your good opinion, that I will leave no ways unsought to attain your favour, which long you have restrained from me. And in all the duties of a wife, I beseech you not to run with a settled condemnation of me, for my heart cannot accuse itself against you. Neither is there anything alleged against me that deserves separation. My lord, I have tended to your happiness in every way, were superfluous to write, for I take God to witness my life has ever been adventured for you, and my heart, notwithstanding what I have suffered, thirsts after your prosperity and desires nothing so much as to have your love. Alas, my lord, what benefits it you to seek my trouble and desolation, or wherein does it serve you to let me live thus, absent from you? If you will say, because I now love you not, I know, my lord, that hatred must grow from something, and how I have deserved your indignation is invisible to me. If you will say that I, or mine, have touched you in duty of allegiance, first I protest there is no such thing. And what can you have more than Her Majesty justified you and us? The lords at the council and my sons clear you, or how can it be thought that I should forget myself so greatly being your wife, and my daughter wife to your eldest son? My lord, I beseech you, give me liberty to come unto you. I doubt not, but in every particular to satisfy you, as my innocence will manifestly appear. And then I trust you will quiet my heart, receiving me into your favour, for you, only you, may do it.
Where do I begin to tell the story of how great a love can be? The sweet love story that is older than the sea. The simple truth about the love she brings to me. Where do I start?
Okay, blow your nose, dry your eyes. I reckon Bess has just gotten the advice of a very smart lawyer and has created evidence that any fault in the marriage was not her, and she was absolutely just looking to patch things up. Bess certainly knew the value of a top lawyer. George might not be quite so smart. What's George got to say?
I want to break free. I want to break free.
Paul Biss is saying,
I want to break free.
Oh, Mary is saying,
God knows, God knows I want to break free.
He'll look for letters of support that he's not responsible for any marriage breakdown from Cecil. Oh, sorry, mate, too busy. Walsingham. Oh, sorry, mate, I'm too crook. And Dudley, who will at least reply, concerning the unkindness of my lady, your wife's dealing, truly, my lord, I am sorry with all my heart for it. I know it must be a great grief to you that any cause of division or mislike should grow that way, and the more where so great a love and goodwill was, and heretofore has been between you. I may only lament, for it is not for me, or for any other, to enter into those causes, disputes between you. Yeah, leave me out of it, that's what he's saying. Worse, of course, if we look at the addresses on these letters, we'll see that Bess is writing from Dudley's house. Nothing going on between Bess and Dudley except a bit of matchmaking. Bella to Dudley's lad, Robert Dudley, Lord Denby. She's 8, he's 2. Kitty's will be betrothed, but Betty had not been informed. That then will have Betty and Mary Queen of Scots both agreeing for once. They both hate the marriage. Dudley is back in the ship with Betty, but not for long. Lord Denby will die a couple of months later. Dudley will get the news and be right off to Lettice Nolly's, who still isn't welcome at Betty's court. Worse, yep, George will now try to break up his lad, Gilbert, from his Mrs. Mary, Bess's daughter. Gilbert doesn't want to break up with Mary. George is saying, I love you the best of my kiddies, but T's and C's apply to that love. Namely, you will give your wife, Mary, the flick. Worse, you know it is. George will go to Chatsworth, where Bess's lad, William Cavendish, is in residence. William will speak Australian to George. Fuck off, you total arsehole. Oh no, that's lewd language, so George will now bring a civil suit against William. His family's rather dysfunctional. George will start making moves on the lands that Bess had brought to the marriage. Oh dear, he's poked Bess in that big red button that says, do not push this big red button. Bess is ready for domestic war. George will punch first, writing to Bess's tenant saying, you guys need to pay your rents to me from now on. It's worse. George carried out a bit of a terror campaign on Bess's children. One of her boys, Charles, had fled to a church, then needed to climb into the steeple to avoid a good kicking by George's hard men. So Bess had fled Chatsworth, taking the best stuff, and will go to live at Hardwick. George will complain that Bess has stolen stuff from his house, Chatsworth. That's not your house, George. That's Bess's house. Servants of Bess's kiddies are getting a beating and property's being destroyed. George has gone fucking nuts. Bess's tenants who paid their rent to her will find their livestock taken and property seized and some get tossed out. George will go back to Chatsworth with a large group of armed men. They will break in and take whatever they can. Bess's lad will go to Sheffield and break in there to recover some stuff, and when George fails to retaliate, he'll go again and get the rest. The gossip, as you might expect, is anti-George and will get worse when George's lad Gilbert will go to see George at Worksop. George has smuggled in Mary Queen of Scots on the quiet, and joining them was George's first wife's brother, the Earl of Rutland, who is a Catholic zealot. Betty and the Privy Council will be unanimous on this. George cannot be trusted any longer with the Scotty Queen. He will be allowed to take Mary to Buxton in July 1584, but when he gets home, Ralph Sadler is there to look after Mary, while George is finally going to get to see Betty. Off he goes to see Betty, but first it's a Privy Council meeting, and George is invited to take his place. George will want an assurance that he's not there to be charged or vilified for his dealings with Mary, which he's not. He will then look to stop two of Bess's boys getting a knighthood, promoting his lads instead. Then he can lodge his complaint about Bess's lad who spoke that Australian to him, and Sir William will be straight off to the Fleet Street prison without a trial. Bess will force a court case and get him out. George can go to see Cecil and Betty, and it's clear that he's lost it. And that's it. After more than 15 years, George is free of Mary. Mary will have another go at Bess, writing to Betty that Bess had said Betty was banging Edward de Vere, Earl of Oxford, Christopher Hatton, and that Frenchy guy, Simier, and said that Bess said Betty was vain and everybody laughs at her behind her back and so on. Walsingham will, of course, intercept that letter, and Betty will never see it. Mary and George, though, will be happy that Bess and Lance will be on the carpet for spreading rumours that George had got Mary up the spout. It's a nothing burger, and all will be exonerated. Mary Queen of Scots will not see an improvement in her position at all. She's away from the benevolent George Talbot and off to Wingfield Manor with Sir Ralph Sadler, who she hates. Mary will be happy, though, to hear that her lad Jim Six has put down a rebellion. She'll send a message about one of the rebels, Lord Lindsay, who'd been one of those guys who'd rebelled against her. She wants his head off. Nah, says Jim Six, just toss him in the slammer. Mary's envoys will let her know that Jim did not ask whether Mary was well or if her conditions were okay. October 1584, and Jim will send an ambassador to London to get the extradition of rebel lords and form a nice treaty. In an act of good faith, he will divulge all the plotting he knows on Mary. Mary, of course, thinks he's on her side. No, Mary, he's not. 13th of January, 1585, and Mary's back in Tutbury, the place she hates most. Sir Amos Paulet, one of those harsh Puritans, will be in charge. He's heard about Mary's charm and will look to annoy her. The cloth of state behind her chair is gone. Mary will complain, and Paulet will say, yeah, it's not officially sanctioned. No cloth of state for you. Mary had been able to establish rapport with pretty much anyone, even Ralph Sadler, who she hated, but nothing will work on Paulet. He was acting under orders from Walsingham. It's to be a strict regime for Mary. No going out for anything. No handing out arms to the poor, or any other little acts of kindness for the common smellies. Paulet will also stamp out the secret mail, and Mary's only allowed to get letters from the Frenchy ambassador, which Paulet will open and examine first. If he's not happy with them, then Mary won't get them. No visits to Buxton and the Magic Water. Paulet will reduce the number of Mary's attendants to keep a better eye on them, and they'll be subject to the same harsh regime as Mary. Mary will be unwell. Paulet gives no fucks. It's retribution for your sins, missy. Frenchies will learn about this and pressure Betty to at least move Mary somewhere better than Tutbury. Off she goes to Chartley Hall with Earl of Essex Robert Devereux, Walter and Lettice Nolly's lad, having a big old whinge about Mary moving into his house. That will cause a delay, so Mary ended up spending a full year at Tutbury. In she goes for another health breakdown, and even Paulet will provide her with a down mattress. You might recall we had that Throckmorton plot that was foiled. Cecil and Walsingham had a good hard think about that and have come up with the Act of Association. What this says is that Mary doesn't have to be directly involved in a plot to be guilty of treason. If someone else, anybody else, comes up with a plot to free her, then that would be enough to find her guilty of treason, even if she doesn't know a thing about it. Yes, it's tailor-made legislation to get Mary dead. Just in case that's not enough, Walsingham will look to get a plot going. He's got plenty of agents who can start spreading that, firstly, foreign intervention is imminent, and secondly, that the size of the subversive Catholic groups in England is way bigger than it actually was. In comes a guy, Gilbert Gifford, straight out of Catholic school in Reims. He's charming and a skilled linguist. Walsingham will have him arrested and offer some professional torture and a nasty death, or you can take a job, mate. Which will Gilbert pick? He'll pick a job. Gifford will visit the Frenchy embassy and say, hey guys, I can get letters into Mary Queen of Scots. Great, they say, even without checking that his flatmate is a known Walsingham agent. It's to be a leather pouch concealed in a beer barrel. In goes the mail that we've already read. Out comes the beer barrel with the replies that will go back to Paulet to vet them and then on to Walsingham. It's all in cipher, but our crowd cracker is on the job. The packet is resealed by Walsingham's seal forger, then back on to the Frenchies. Off from there to Paris. Everybody's happy. Mary's got a mail service back in operation. Paulette can confirm his prisoner is a bad, bad girl. Walsingham can manipulate the conspiracy, and even the brewer gets paid twice, once by each side. That's going nicely, and happy for Walsingham, here comes another plot. Do you remember, my dear listener, we met 10-year-old page boy Anthony Babington when he took service with George Talbot? Probably you don't, but he's now 25-year-old Anthony Babington, who'd grown up around Mary and become a fanboy. 1586, and Babington will make contact with our original plotters to make things extra easy for Walsingham. Shortly after, Mary will write her first letter to him, addressed rather badly. Master Anthony Babington, dwelling most in Derbyshire in a house of his own within 2 miles of Wingfield, as I doubt not you know, for that in this shire he has many friends and kinsmen. No problems. Walsingham's guys will make absolutely certain that Babington will absolutely get that letter. Babington's reply shows how stupid he was. Plain language, very detailed plot to kill Betty and free Mary. Well, he doesn't actually name Betty, even though he's not that stupid. It's the usurping competitor who is to be killed. Myself with 10 gentlemen and 100 of your followers will undertake the delivery of your royal person from the hands of your enemies, for the dispatch of the usurper from the obedience of whom we are by the excommunication of her made free. There will be 6 noble gentlemen, all my private friends, who for the zeal they bear for the Catholic cause and your Majesty's service will undertake that tragical execution.
When I was just a little baby boy, my mama used to tell me these crazy things. She used to tell me my daddy was an evil man. She used to tell me he hated me. But then I got a little bit older and I realized she was the crazy one. But there was nothing I could do or say to try to change it, cause that's just the way she was. They said I can't rap about being broke no more. They say I can't rap about coke no more. Slut, you think I won't choke no whore till the vocal cords don't work in the throat no more? These motherfuckers are thinking I'm saying this shit cause I'm thinking it just to be saying it. Put your hands down, bitch, I ain't gonna shoot you. I'ma pull you to this bullet and put it through you. Shut up, slut, you're causing too much chaos. Just bend over and take it like a slut, okay, ma? Oh, now he's raping his own mother, abusing a horse, snorting coke, and we gave him the Rolling Stone cover? You goddamn right, bitch, and I was too late. I'm triple platinum and tragedies happen in 2 states. I invented violence, you vile venomous, vile little bitches, veins, Vicodin, ring, ring, ring. Takes his chainsaw, let his brains off, dangling from his neck while his head barely hangs on. Blood, guts, guns, cuts, knives, lies, wives, nuns, sluts. Bitch, I'ma kill you. You don't wanna fuck with me. Girls need you, ain't nothing but a slut to me. Bitch, I'ma kill you. You ain't got the balls to beef. We ain't gonna never stop beefing. I don't squash the beef. You better kill me. I'ma be another rapper dead for popping off at the mouth with shit I shouldn't have said. But when they kill me, I'm bringing the world with me. Bitches too, you ain't nothing but a girl to me.
If you weren't a fan of Eminem before, you are now, I'm sure. 14th of July, and Mary will get that happy letter, after Walsingham's read it, of course, and the words tragical execution are just what he wants. Mary will write a disappointing reply, just acknowledging the letter. Don't underestimate Mary, though. 3 days later, it's a full reply saying, great stuff, but you need Spain on side. Walsingham's codebreaker will read this and happily draw a gallows on the cover before sending it on to Walsingham. Then shall it be time to set the 6 gentlemen to work, taking order. Upon the accomplishment of their design, I may suddenly be transported out of this place. Yes, it's her acknowledgement of those 6 gentlemen and their design that has done it for Mary. Time for Walsingham to send it on to Babington, but Mary had left space at the bottom of that letter. Ah, silly idea, Mary. Nice bit of forgery to put in another line asking for the names of the 6 gentlemen who were to do the dirty deed to kill Betty. This again is something that puzzles historians. Why did Mary do all this? All I can say is, why did she marry Darnley? Why did she marry Bothwell? Why did she run to England when she could have run to France? I think she's not too bright. That's what I've come up with. Mind you, she's had a year of rough stuff at Tutbury and knew about the Act of Association that we can all see is designed to get it. So perhaps it was one last roll of the dice. And just before getting the letter from Babington, King Jim VI and Betty had signed a treaty with 0 mention of Mary in it. That's letting her know that King Jim has zero interest in her, his mum. The treaty came about because our legislators had raised the bar with the Act for the Queen's Safety. A dickhead piece of legislation, if ever I saw one. It enables any English person to hunt down and kill anyone involved in a plot. Now that could bring anarchy. Go and kill that annoying neighbour, then just tell the authorities he'd been thinking bad thoughts about Betty. Betty would be a bit worried about it. If she were to be killed, does this act mean we might want to kill King Jim VI? Jim will be exempted, and we get that treaty going, which hints that he could be next in line for the English silly hat. Like his mum, the succession is a huge deal for Jim. He'll write to Mary saying, "You will now be named Queen Mother and never ever be Queen again." Mary will boo-hoo-hoo and get to some spewing before writing back, "There is no king or queen in Scotland apart from me, you little ingrate. I am so grievously offended at my heart at the impiety and ingratitude that this child has been constrained to commit against me." Worse, you know it. The last of the four Marys, Mary Seton, is 43 and not a well Mary. She's off to fulfil her lifelong ambition to be a nun at Reims under Mary of Guise's sister Renee. 19th of July and Walsingham got that letter. Gilbert Gifford has completed his mission and he'll be on the next water Uber out of England. He may have been working for Walsingham, but that would be unlikely to prevent his arrest when shit gets real. 29th of July, Babington will get the letter. 3rd of August, Babington will reply, acknowledging receipt of her instructions. Walsingham already has guys out to make arrests. Arrests start and Babington is off. 10 days later, he'll be nabbed in St. John's Wood disguised as a peasant with green slime on his face. 4 days of torture to get all the details of the plot out of him. We already knew it, but we just want him to say it. 8th of August, and Mary will be told she's been invited to go hunting on the 16th. Oh, joy! She'll put on her best frock. Off she goes, galloping around with Paul left behind her. And look, over there, it's a bunch of gentlemen riding in. Mary thinks it's Team Babington, but it's not. It's Team Arrest Mary. Mary's servants will be dragged off, and she thinks it's going to be death on the spot. Well, her lady-in-waiting will stay so Mary can boo-hoo-hoo all over that poor, now damp lady. Mary will refuse to remount until Paulette told her, "Fine, I'll just drag you along behind me." That'll get her back on a horsey. Off we all go to Tixall and close confinement. Betty's plan is this may give us death by natural causes. Cecil will say sure, but she might live for years yet. Mary will get a couple of chamber women and a change of clothes. 25th of August and Mary is being moved to Chartley. Beggars will be calling out for alms. Mary will say, "Alas, good people, I have nothing for you, for I am a beggar as well as you." Quick stop off for Mary to get her stuff, which has been chucked around and plundered. Her letters and cipher codes are all gone. The only thing they'd missed was the cash. Oddly enough, missing the cash. Not like our guys, is it? The cash she used to pay for her servants. Paulette will be having that. Walsingham will be in to tell Betty, who will panic a bit, not knowing that a lot of this was manufactured by Walsingham. Yeah, he's got it all under control. 20th of September, 1586, and Babington with his good buddies are off to be hanged, drawn and quartered. He'd offered Betty £1,000 for a pardon, but obviously he didn't know how this attainted thing goes. Betty got all his stuff anyway. Babington wrote a final letter to his very good friend, Robin Poley, saying, "Farewell, my sweet Robin." Yeah, sweet Robin was Walsingham's guy, who got Babington that rather nasty end. But Mary's name had not been mentioned in the legal proceedings against these guys. There were 13 guys up for execution, which is a pretty big job, so the idea was to do them in two batches over 2 days. Babington had been done on day one, with the executioner doing some sort of spectacular job. Very nasty, and the mob are not happy. The guys on day two then copped a lucky break, with Betty saying, "Hang them till they're dead before doing the rest of the nasty business." Babington had been smart enough to burn Mary's letters to him. Didn't matter. Walsingham had copies and used his forger to make it Mary's handwriting. Mary's secretaries will be brought in, tickled up a bit, and then say, yes, certainly is Mary's writing. Mary will be very unhappy about this particular betrayal, but she really should be used to betrayal by now. Mary's in Texel, thinking she'll cop a dose of poison or something, because surely Betty won't be given a trial. Oh, yes, she will. And when Mary found that out, she became rather pleased with the thought of a trial and execution, and then on to martyrdom. Yeah, she's caught a nasty dose of that martyr's complex. She's got the idea that this will make her famous, with lots of history books to be written in the future, and maybe even a movie or two. Off she goes again in the custody of hard men to Fotheringay, that place built by Edmund of York. Well, the original building on the site had been Bill the Bastard, but it became a Yorkist thingy, with even our dear old Dick III being born there. It's like Catherine of Aragon again. We don't want a trial in London. Too many sympathisers. Mary will be in a small locked room, with the servants telling her it looks like the place is being prepared for a trial. In come the commissioners to chat amongst themselves first. We'll go over the Babington plot, then decide Mary will be tried under that Act of Association. Not a good sign for Mary. 24 guys will be appointed, including George Talbot. He'll try to be excused, but no, George, you are in. More than one guy will warn George he'd better not get a runny nose and take a sickie, otherwise the chap may turn to his performance as Mary's keeper. Mary knows that the trial will be done under the Act of Association and that will make it a done deal and that she will be found guilty. But just to make certain, our commissioners won't be allowing her legal counsel or witnesses for the defence. She's on her own. While we're at it, she can't have a clerk to make notes. Mary, incidentally, could barely speak English, just to make it all a bit harder. That entire trial was illegal anyway. There is nothing in place for one country to try the sovereign of another country for treason. What you do is just deport them back to where they live. But we aren't going to be doing that. This trial also goes against Magna Carta, which says you can only be tried by your peers. That would mean the only person in England who could try Mary is Betty. Bring on the legal bullshit, then. They will say that it's suzerainty England has over Scotland. Now, the English have believed that at various times, but the Scotties have never gone along with it. What they could have tried to make it legal was to put Mary into the succession for England. The trial would then look at least a little bit legal, but we're not going to be putting Mary into the succession ever. Not even now. We're about to kill her, and she still can't go in. Cecil's chipped in by rearranging the parliamentary session. He wants those Mary-hating Puritan commons operating the same time as the trial. They'll need to tick off on anything the court needs if they're struggling to get a conviction. And when they do get a conviction, the commons will need to endorse that conviction and the sentence. Yeah, the Puritans should be finding that pretty easy. A delegation will go to see Mary to give her a copy of the commission and will ask her to turn up in person and acknowledge the legality of proceedings. A letter from Betty saying, hey Mary, you're in my place, so you're subject to my laws. Love, Betty. Mary will reply, I am myself a queen, the daughter of a king, a stranger, and the true kinswoman of the Queen of England. I came to England on my cousin's promise of assistance against my enemies and rebel subjects, and was at once imprisoned. As an absolute queen, I cannot submit to orders, nor can I submit to the laws of the land without injury to myself, the king my son, and all other sovereign princes. Yeah, all others. For myself, I do not recognise the laws of England, nor do I understand them, as I have often asserted. I am alone, without counsel or anyone to speak on my behalf. My papers and notes have been taken from me, so I am destitute of all aid, taken at disadvantage. Yeah, that pretty much sums it up for me. I think Mary's hit the nail right on the head there. Mary has pointed out that this is taking things to a new level, and it will affect every monarch in Europe. A monarch cannot submit to laws of other countries. Mary may have to, though. The guys will have a good hard think about it and tell Mary that she is certainly subject to the laws of England, and if she doesn't turn up, then she'll be tried in absentia. Mary will say, listen, dickhead, I am not a subject of England, and if I concede to English laws, then I'll be betraying the majesty of kings. I'll be happy to appear before Parliament and answer questions, but I'm not submitting to you guys, who have no doubt condemned me already before I've even said anything. It will be some boo-hoo-hooing, then. Look to your consciences and remember the world is a bigger place than England. Mary will continue to resist until 14th of October, when the charge is reduced to a single item, that she plotted to kill Betty. Betty had meantime written a nicer letter saying, "Hey, kiddo, I kept you alive for quite a while with great care and affection. Write a nice letter back and you might get some more of my legendary affection." Now, once again, historians puzzle why Mary backed down and agreed to face the commission. But it could just be that she knows she's gone, so we'll be thinking about marvellous speeches for you and I to go over in the future. If you're going to be killed, then make a good end, and that will be remembered type of thing. Plus, it's a chance to put her version of the last 19 years since she left Scotland firmly on record. 15th of October, 1586, a date that will live in infamy. Oh, must be another FDR day. Trial of Mary, Queen of Scots. Mary will get a nice chair to sit on. Nothing else for her. The room has been set up all nicely and very intimidating. The best legal minds in England are there. The evidence table is overflowing with documents that Mary hasn't been allowed to see. In comes Mary under armed guard, wearing a dress and mantle of black velvet, relieved by her white headdress and long white veil. She's actually not in very good condition and will be helped by a couple of guys. The commissioners at least will take off their hats and bow. Mary will say, "I am a queen by right of birth and my place should be there under the dais." But she'll sit where she's told and say to a servant, "Look at all these lawyers and not one for me." A speech will be made to outline the reason for the trial. Mary's response will be, "Don't recognise this court, which has never ever worked for anybody." Then it's about the circumstances causing her to rush on into England. She only agreed to appear to clear her name against this particular charge of conspiring to kill Betty. Never done it. Court will say there was no promise of help made by Betty, and forget that shit about this court can't try you. Look, we're doing it now. Of course we can. Mary will say, "Well, I didn't approve this court or your constitution for proceeding it being based on a brand new law that was made just to stitch me up." Bring on the first witness, Sergeant Gordy, who will give us the events leading to the arrest of Mary, including the capture of Babington and his fellow assassins. We'll circulate Babington's confession and depositions from Mary's two secretaries, who, as you recall, had kind of turned state's evidence after that tea and chat at the torture chamber, saying, "Yeah, that is her handwriting." Mary will say, "Your evidence is crap and show me these letters allegedly signed by me." Mary can then say, "They're forgeries. That's not my writing. In any case, can I be responsible for the criminal projects of a few desperate men which they planned without my knowledge or participation?" Sadly, Mary, you can, because of that legislation. The rest of the day will be a hodgepodge of producing documents or prosecutors making speeches, with Mary not knowing what's coming next. The court will get to the suzerainty thing and Mary will say, "My advancing age and bodily weakness both prevent me from wishing to resume the reins of government. I have perhaps only 2 or 3 years to live in this world, and I do not aspire to any public position, especially when I consider the pain and desperance which met those who wished to do right, and to act with justice and dignity in the midst of so perverse a generation, and when a whole world is full of crimes and troubles." Cecil will then get up Mary for not ratifying that Treaty of Edinburgh proposed 30 years earlier, back when you and I, my dear listener, said that certainly should have been accepted by the Scotties. But Mary's guys wanted to bang on about the mad Welsh King's will instead. Dickheads. Cecil is saying, "You didn't accept that great offer because you, missy, wanted to usurp our Gloriana's big chair." Mary's turn. "I do not desire vengeance. I leave it to him who is the just avenger of the innocent and of those who suffer for his name, under whose power I will take shelter. I would rather play with Esther than take the sword with Judith. Then she will get stuck into Walsingham, and Mary will say it was Walsingham who contrived the whole plot. Well spotted, Mary. Walsingham will say, God is my witness that as a private person I have done nothing unworthy of an honest man, and as Secretary of State nothing unbefitted my duty. And there you go, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. The nicest of humans can do totally crap stuff for their particular organisation of choice and justify it by saying, hey, it's just business. But I personally am just a marvellous guy. Mary will demand to see her two secretaries because their depositions were obtained by torture, she says. I want to question them directly. For my part, I do not wish to accuse my secretaries, but I see plainly that what they have said is from fear of torture and death. Under promise of their lives, and in order to save themselves, they have excused themselves at my expense, fancying that I could thereby more easily save myself. At the same time, not knowing where I was, and not suspecting the manner in which I am treated. And the trial will descend into chaos, with guys just yelling out accusations or whatever, kill the bitch, that type of stuff. Day two, and Mary will ask to address the court. She'll kick off by pointing out that, yes, they have been a bit of a shit show, and you guys are behaving like small-town lawyers with your trickery and bullshit. There is not one, I think, among you, let him be the cleverest man you will, but would be incapable of resisting or defending himself if he were in my place. Yeah, she understands the situation. The commission will summarise the main points from day one, then get started on correspondence with Spanish Phil. Oi, says Mary, you can't be reading letters between sovereign princes. Cecil will say, what would you have done if Phil invaded? Mary will answer, I was always just looking to get out of the summer, that's all. Commissioners will just up the accusations with all sorts of stuff. Mary's had enough. She'll tell them she's old and infirm and a threat to nobody. She's got no ambition and her dear lad Jim Six belongs to Betty as much as herself. And it was a shame that Betty had driven a wedge between mother and son by sending him lots and lots of pocket money. Then she'll rise and pardon the commission for what they've done. On the way out, she'll say something to Walsingham. We've got no idea what, but it won't make him happy. Then it's, may God pardon you and keep me from having much to do with you. And she's left. 10 days later, the commission will reconvene at the Star Chamber. In come Mary's secretaries to say, oh yeah, we gave our evidence freely and frankly. They couldn't really say anything else. Time for the verdict, and it's not guilty. Oh, hang on, can't read my own writing. No, guilty, of course. It was never going to be anything else. Only one voice of dissent, young Lord Zouche, who, if your memory is really, really good, was an associate of Bess of Hardwick. Don't know why I say that. Bess and Mary ended up hating each other. The commission will formally note that King Jim VI had nothing at all to do with Mary's naughtiness. The verdict will sail through both the Commons and the Lords and be presented to Betty with the request being the death penalty. Betty will write back saying, hey guys, one thing for Parliament to ask for the death penalty of a Queen, but another thing entirely for me to give it. What else have you got? The only thing they've got is clemency. But in order to give clemency, the condemned has to say, oh yeah, I was certainly guilty, and now I beg you for your pardon. Paulette will go to Mary saying, change your plea to guilty, beg forgiveness, and things will go well for you. That'll be a no. Betty will ponder and send more guys in to talk to Mary. They'll be blunt. It's not possible that both you and Betty can live. One of you's got to go, and that'll be you. But wait. Betty hasn't given that death warrant the tick, so there's still time to repent. Mary will say, look, mate, I've already decided to be a martyr to the true religion. Our guys will say, well, you're dying as a traitor, not some sort of saint or martyr. They're going nowhere. Paulette will again remove a cloth of state, saying, you're a dead woman, without dignity or honour of a queen. Paulette had rudely remained seated to add an insult, but he will offer to restore the royal cloth. Mary will just put a crucifix in its place. Being queen no longer matters to her. It's now her new role as martyr to the faith that matters. need just a little bit more of Brian May to get us into some historical fiction. And this week I had a crack at the new TV series about Baby Betty's mum, Anne Boleyn. This is the one with the black actress as Anne, and of course a black actor as her brother George. And I must say, I probably made some progress, because when they first started whacking black actors into roles of old English people, I wasn't too happy with it. I might have hit a bit of a turning point with the Hollow Crown series, Henry VI, where Queen Marguerite was played by a black actor, and she did a bang-up job of it. And this Anne Boleyn does a bang-up job of the Anne Boleyn role, I reckon. She does a marvellous job, I think. The only way I've got to progress now is to just totally ignore whether people are black or white in the roles and just appreciate their acting. This is a short series, only 3 episodes, for your delight. It covers just the last few months of Anne's life. I reckon they did a great job of it. My man Cromwell, who you know I admire, of course he's a bit of a villain in this. You're not going to like Tom Cromwell much at all. But overall, I just think it was a really good series. I'm sad it was only 3 episodes. I would have liked more of Anne Boleyn. But there you go. We know what happens in the end. She dies. And so it's just a matter of what we go out with. And I got to thinking with this Anne Boleyn TV series I just watched. If Anne Boleyn's black, what does that make our Betty? Hope to see you next week. Bye.
Oh, Black Betty. Bamba lamb, oh Black Betty, bamba lamb, Black Betty, bamba lamb, Black Betty, bamba lamb, jump sturdy, Black Betty, bamba lamb, jump sturdy.